Thanks for listening to this week's Lefevre CFC podcast. Connect with us via our website, lefevrecfc.com, or our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/lefevrecfc. We hope you enjoy this week's message.
Enter into a bit of a worship time. We're going to start with 10,000 Reasons, which is a nice song that we can just kind of belt out as we prepare our hearts for our service.
Well, we are getting close to the end of our Encountering Jesus series, but I do have a little announcement about that, and that is that next week, Pastor Bill Vasilakis will be here to bring it home. So those of you who know our kind of denominational affiliation is within the CRC Churches International, but within that, we're a kind of network of churches under the Christian Family Centre, and that's really largely organised out of Seton, Christian Family Centre. So Bill is the chairman of the board of all of the CFC churches, and he's also the senior minister for Christian Family Centre. So he will be here and closing the series, and we had planned originally that we would have a little bit of a maybe a dinner and a Q&A in the hall. Wow, how times have changed. With the idea that there have been a few sort of structural changes, and many of you may not have had the chance to kind of shoot the breeze about how the CFC structure works. Where does that sit with CRC? Where does kind of the legal and institutional kind of framework sort of sit with our local church? We kind of thought it would be good for Bill to perhaps afterwards, anyone that was desperate to know about all that stuff, maybe stay behind and he can do a little bit of a talk and you guys can ask him some questions. That will have to wait, but another time. We're looking forward to having him next week, and then we're going to move, as the newsletter says, into a new series called Transforming Grace. And if you are keen, now I don't know if we've actually organised anything with this, but we're going to be working through a book called The Prodigal God by Tim Keller, and that's really the kind of foundation for us working through a series of, studies on understanding God's grace towards us. So if you've got The Prodigal God, or you've got a Kindle and you want to sort of download it and start reading, that would be great. Maybe we could make sure that we can get a few bootleg copies or a few from somewhere and make them available to anyone that's keen to read as we go. So there'll be 6 studies and 6 weeks with that. And I think that's a really important follow-up to the things we're working through at the moment. Before I begin, I'm going to invite Isaac, who's going to locate us in Mark, in the final stanza, if you like, in Mark 15, and he's going to locate us at the cross. In the original, Mark doesn't spend much time about this, because he's kind of, once he has this message that Jesus is the Messiah firmly there, he's not kind of overly interested in what happens next, as some of the other gospel writers are. Isaac, come and read to us. And if you're reading along, we're in Mark 15, and Isaac's just going to read from verse 33 to 39 for us.
At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema." Don't know what that other word is. Which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with white vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God."
Thank you very much. Good. I'm glad you did include that last verse, because that's the whole point of that section for me today. Thank you. Great. That was fantastic. So I'm just going to quickly skip back, because this is the third in this series that I've done, and it's kind of followed a bit of a structure. So if you've missed some of those, I just want to quickly locate what we're doing today in the kind of overall plan. So John Mark is believed to be the author of the book of Mark. He sat down with Peter later in his life and got him to kind of tell him about him and Jesus, the Jesus story. And so it was a kind of narrative method. And that's why Peter has such an intimate sense in the book of Mark, because it's him reflecting on his life. And Mark 1 verse 1, the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. So he starts with that, okay? And he bookends it with the same message, because this is really the one thing that Mark wants us to take away and to never forget it, because this is the only thing that matters in his mind, and he keeps coming back to that. And so we talked in the first week about some of the things that happened in kind of the front end of Mark, and that famous story of Jesus calming the storm is a really well-known one. And then we looked at the sections of Mark. So the first sort of chapter 1 through to the first half of chapter 8 is about Jesus' ministry in the north. There's a lot of miracles, okay? So there's Jesus being baptized, there's Jesus healing the blind, feeding the 5,000, calming the seas, and we've had Effie and Paul and others talking about the woman who'd been bleeding for 12 years. You've got the demon-possessed man bound in chains living in the cemetery. And so all that's happening until we get to this midsection. So this is a turning point in the book of Mark. And the disciples thought they understood that Jesus was the Messiah in a certain way as he's doing these miracles. But then in this end of chapter 8 through to chapter 10, he kind of flips their thinking again. There's a range of things that happened, like the transfiguration, for example. That kind of gets them thinking a little bit. And we've got Peter, where he says, "I know who you are. You're Jesus the Messiah," which sounded like the right answer. And then Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan," because his idea of the Messiah was that he was going to liberate them in a military sense, that he would come like a soldier or some sort of military leader and overthrow Rome. So the messianic notion that Peter had, he still didn't get it. And Jesus three times, focuses on children. And so he's kind of reminding us of what's important and rethinking how power works in the kingdom of God. Then the back end of Mark is all on the way to Jerusalem, and leads to the cross. And the structure here that lays it out sort of shows there. We did have that one earlier. So remember, the front end was don't tell anyone. Jesus heals someone, says don't say anything about, don't tell people who I am. Then there's the transfiguration, where Jesus doesn't tell people who he is, but it's revealed who he is. And then they get to the point, for example, if you think when people in the Palm Sunday, right, so the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, people are waving palm branches and throwing their cloaks on the ground as he rides the colt into the city, and people are singing and shouting and crying out, "Hosanna to the Son of David." And he's saying, look, if they don't say it, even the rocks will cry out. So now he's saying, say it. You can say it. You can say it loud, and you can say it lots of times. So this whole thing about coming to understand Jesus as the Messiah and communicating that goes through this journey. And it ends with this moment here, which is a pretty powerful, poignant moment. And as Isaac just read out, Jesus cries out in anguish. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is in Aramaic. And there are some people that kind of say, well, the Bible is kind of a little bit skewed, where people kind of write what they want, say what they want to fit the narrative that they want. And this is where, in this father-son relationship, in this moment, where if that were the case here, there is no way that all of the gospel writers would put this in. For first thing, it's not in Greek, okay? But they remembered it. It's stuck in their mind because he's crying out in anguish and in Aramaic. Everyone heard it and everyone remembered it because it's unforgettable. And if you were trying to kind of feather the nest of a narrative about Jesus being God's son, you wouldn't put this in, but they all do. Because Jesus refers to his father many, many times, right throughout the Gospels. For example, if you have a look down there, Father, forgive them. My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. That's in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's got that very intimate father-son relationship in his language. Earlier in the book, he says, the Father and I are one. So to get to the cross and that moment of excruciating agony as he's dying, to scream out and not say my Father, but to say my God, why have you forsaken me, doesn't fit the narrative, and yet it's there. Even when Jesus was 12, you might remember the story, and he goes missing for a few days and his mum can't find him and his dad can't find him and no one can find him, and it turns out he's in the temple the whole time. I don't know what you'd say if you lost your 12-year-old for 3 days. What would the first thing you say to your kid be? maybe, but you don't have any 12-year-olds left in the house, do you? Oh, that's good, that's right. One, all right, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when did you last see him, Danny? Oh, that's right, that's fine. Okay. But he says, did you not know that I would be about my father's business? Okay, so he's got a really strong sense that I and the Father are one, my Father, my Father. But at this moment, the language changes. My God, why not Father? Well, one really interesting thing is some people might say, well, maybe he was losing his mind. That's why he's, you know, sort of not, why is he quite measured through all of that torturous journey to the cross? And now he's crying out in a different language and a story that doesn't fit. You might say maybe he'd finally cracked. Maybe he just kind of lost where he was at. Maybe he'd forgotten what it was about. But year before, I can't remember, I talked a little bit about how, you know, particularly, you know, Eastern and Middle Eastern cultures, you know, remembering the memory work to continue by song and story and our histories by reminding is really important. And, you know, if you grew up in Jewish culture back in that day, you would have been remembering the Psalms, reciting the Psalms, and also thinking about what they mean in waiting for the Messiah. The Psalms are really, really, really important. And this is interesting because when you go to Psalm 22, which is a really interesting chapter, guess what verse 1 starts with? My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Written by King David. Why did King David write a chapter, or why did he write a song that started with the opening line, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, you can read it for yourself. It's quite an interesting chapter. But you've got to pick out the bits. I'm just going to sort of skip through a few little bits here, and it's very small. I apologise. I hope. Can you guys read that? Is that sort of microscopic? All right, okay, good. I'm just going to pick from verse 12 here. Many bulls surround me, strong bulls of Bashan, encircle me. Roaring lions that tear their prey open their mouths wide against me. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. Later he says, you lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircle me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. Mind blown, right? Because that's David writing that. But David didn't die like that. This is an execution. That wasn't David's story. But David is invoking something intergenerational of something that was promised to his line, that a Messiah would come. And he's kind of prophesying through this song about what it would look like when a Messiah in the line of David would come. So had Jesus lost the plot? Had he lost his mind? Had he forgotten that God was his father? Had he decided that him and his dad were done? Because there's plenty of commentators out there that would say, God is abusive. Who on earth would do that to their son? God's an abuser. You only need Google to find stuff like that. I haven't seen it for a while, but one Google click will find you stuff like that. But Jesus is not giving up on this idea of the Father's nature and also the relationship, that intimate sense. Even when he's saying my God, he's still saying my God, a bit like I might say my Rebecca or my David. It's still an intimate sense, but it's a direct quote from Psalm 22. Because what he's doing is he's saying David's already foretold that one would come whose hands and feet would be pierced, whose bones would be on display, that people would stare and gloat over me, and that they would divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. Guess what's happening at the foot of the cross with these greedy, ignorant, sort of self-serving, you know, low-level soldiers? That piece of cloth that was made for Jesus, they're busy gambling. Actually, exactly as verse 18 foretells. So rather than Jesus giving up, losing the plot, you know, reverting to a childhood language out of some sort of dysphoria, no, he's locating himself. So you must think, I reckon, when you get to that point, Jesus still was in control. He still had his faculties about him, and he still knew who he was, and he hadn't given up on that father-son relationship. He was just announcing himself as the Messiah that David foretold in Psalm 22. That's pretty amazing. And as this is all happening, there's a first-time encounter that happens. The Roman centurion. Okay, so I'm not a military expert in ancient Rome, but I think when you make 100 in cricket, it's called a century, and 100 years is called a century, and I think a centurion's got about 100 blokes underneath him in the army, something like that. That's a pretty big responsibility, but these are not guys born into wealth that sort of, when you think of ancient Rome, the guys with people fanning them and lying back and people putting grapes in their mouth and sort of falling over themselves to dust them off. That's something else. These are the guys who started off as young soldiers, and they had to grind their way up the ladder, and eventually they have a responsibility in the military. This guy has killed a lot of people, and he's seen a lot of people killed. He's probably overseen executions like this so many times it's become normal and routine. Okay? So he is not an emotional sobbing mess because he's just seen somebody bleed and he can't find a band-aid. Something happens to him. Something penetrates a stony heart and pierces the darkness of his soul. And it's an encounter with Jesus. It's the first encounter upon Jesus' death. Because the verse before says that the temple curtain ripped, so the way is made open that anyone can have a relationship with God the Father. You don't need a priest. You don't need an intermediate. You don't need anything else. You can own that relationship just like Jesus did. My Father. You can call him my Father. I think it's good to remember that Jesus wasn't giving up on that relationship. You know, there are lots of people in the world who've had very poor modelling and very even disappointing or hurtful or even abusive father relationships. And for some people, that's a lifetime journey trying to work that out and trying to get through it. But the thing is that God is a good father, and he never gives up on you, and he never gives up on his son Jesus. Jesus did not denounce his relationship with the Father. He's announcing himself as the Messiah. So the centurion stands here. He watches what's going on. It's interesting that Mark's not quite as interested in what's happening in the natural environment as other gospel accounts are. He kind of talks about the darkness. He talks about a couple of things, but he mainly wants to get to the Jesus is the Messiah bit. But if you read other gospel accounts, there's some pretty crazy things going on. The earth is cast in darkness in the middle of the day, and it's not an eclipse. Okay, and we know that because of the Passover and all these different festivals and where the moon is and all that sort of thing. It's something unnatural in that sense, or supernatural, you might say. There are bits going on where the earth shakes. There's an earthquake, a huge earthquake. I don't know how you'd be if you were, you know, at work, at your on-the-run job, sort of pouring slushies and making coffees and pressing the fuel button when people need to put their fuel, and then suddenly the sun goes dark, the earth shakes. And how about if you started to see deceased people walking up and down the street who'd somehow come out of their graves? I think you'd say that would be an unusual day at work. And I think for the centurion, this was a very unusual day at work, because he'd done this many, many, many times. Yeah. And so he sees Jesus cry out, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." He's had the whole interactions with the two other men on the cross. He's endured the mocking. He's gone through all that. He's been reasonably measured, but now he's crying out in anguish in a way that no one will forget. And he stands up, and again, I'm sorry about the size of the text, but he stood there in front of Jesus, saw how he died, and said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." So he puts it all in place. He's not a Jew. He didn't grow up reciting psalms and learning the books of the law and going to the temple. He's a Roman soldier. But that moment, he had an encounter with Jesus, and he saw who Jesus was. And I think what the really good news for all of us is that at that moment, when he makes that declaration, he must have thought to himself, "I have just put to death the Son of God." Imagine that dawning on you, and yet he makes that public declaration. In other words, he's salvageable. He is not beyond God's grace and forgiveness. He is not so stony hard and so cold and dark in his heart that the grace of Jesus cannot break through in that moment, because it does. So the centurion, in a way, in that moment of the temple curtain being open and a new covenant being ushered in, he's the first one. And if he is worthy of God's grace and love, and that he could call God my Father, then what does that say for us? That's good news, isn't it? That is good news. None of us are beyond God's reach, and he has made us a way that we can encounter him, and that we are never the same. So that's a first encounter. And I just want to dip back for a moment to a long-time encounter or a long-term encounter. And this is the Peter story that I talked about in the first message in this series that I did. And these are the moments that really mattered for Peter. Jesus restoring him after he'd run away, he'd given up, went back to fishing. He must have felt completely guilty, broken, ashamed. He must have felt unreachable. He must have. And yet Jesus is there, cooking fish, restoring him. But it's not until something else happens that we know that Peter is remade, that he's become who Jesus always said he would. "Simon, you're like a reed blown in the wind," he said, "but you're going to become a rock, and on that rock I will build my church." The moment where you know that Peter's transitioned, it's not just the knowing, but now it's the being. It's the transformation, the encounter. Really, we get to see it in Acts chapter 2. Okay, so Jesus has ascended to heaven, and the disciples are waiting in the upper room, and the Holy Spirit descends on them like tongues of fire on their head. They begin to speak in different languages, and they're in the public square. There's people, if you read beginning of Acts chapter 2, from all over the world, from every culture, language, skin tone, religious belief, they're all there. It's a super diverse place. And as people begin to speak out this new language, they are speaking in everyone else's language, and it's starting to get a bit wonky. All right, it's getting hectic in there. And I reckon the old Peter, 40 days ago, 80 days ago, might have just said, "Hey guys, I reckon I'm a bit hungry. Anyone for some unleavened bread? Or should we go and have a look for a new donkey? Or, you know, maybe just found a little reason to duck out the back door and just see what happens." Or, like the Garden of Gethsemane, think about why he went there with a sword on his hip. And he acted out of reaction. He cut off a temple servant's ear. Now, remember I said, he said, "Jesus, you're the Messiah." And Jesus said, get behind me, Satan," because Peter had a military kind of sense about what this Messiah would be about. He still didn't get it in the Garden of Gethsemane because he's got a sword. Jesus didn't need Peter to be there with a sword. And he didn't need him to cut off the temple servant's ear either, because Jesus' kingdom is about something else. But now Peter stands up. And this is where you know that an encounter has resulted in transformation. He's not scared anymore. He's not flaky and reactive. He's not letting his pride get out there and he follows, because that's kind of one of his problems, that his pride was almost like a barrier to Jesus' grace at points. I mean, there's so many opportunities for Peter to grasp it, but he's really full of pride. And I can relate to that. You know, we've actually got to let go of our pride in order to accept Jesus' grace. And Peter's ready now. He stands up. There's a big, long address. And if you want to understand how much Peter now understands who Jesus really is, read the whole thing. I'm just going to read a couple of bits. This is verse 22 in Acts 2. "Fellow Israelites, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him." And then he goes on to quote King David. And he's making that link that David foretold a Messiah would come through his line. So he's relocating Jesus as the Messiah to follow in David's line. Later on, verse 29, "Fellow Israelites, I can tell you confidently that the patriarch David died and was buried, and his tomb is here to this day. But he was a prophet and knew that God had promised him on oath that he would place one of his descendants on his throne. My God, why have you forsaken me? What's he doing? He's locating himself as that descendant on the throne of David. And Peter gets it because he's now retelling that story in its full place. Seeing what was to come, he spoke of the resurrection of the Messiah, this is David, that he was not abandoned to the realm of the dead, nor did his body see decay. So that importance of David foretelling the Messiah is retold again. So it's not a mistake that Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Peter says, God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of it. Exalted to the right hand of God, he's received from the Father the promised Holy Spirit and has poured out what you now see and hear. And then he goes on finally, therefore let all Israel be assured of this, God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah. When the people heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the other apostles, brothers, what shall we do? We're at that moment. When we come to understand who Jesus is and what that means, we have to ask the same question. Brothers, what shall we do? What will you do? What will I do? We want to be like Peter, where the encounter changes us forever. Peter never went back. Oh yeah, he had his squabbles. I'm sure if he took his sword to some of the early church meetings with Paul, that could have got rowdy. But they worked it out. I think a prideful Peter who didn't know himself and God might have got pretty messed up, but Jesus had done something in him. Because, of course, we're not perfect because we accept Jesus. We still have our behaviours that go with us, and our personality and our experiences and our pride and our failures. We bring all those things with us, but we're on a journey. Peter is on a journey. You're on a journey. I want to encourage you to have a think about what an encounter with Jesus is going to do in your life. Are you a first-time encounter? You might be here and you haven't grown up, like the centurion, in a church family where you had, you know, family members sing Sunday school songs to you or read from the Bible or take you to church. You might be like the centurion where you come to a moment and you say, surely this man is the Son of God. If that's you, you need to know that God loves you and that his arms are open and he wants you to be able to call him Father in the way that Jesus referred to his Father right throughout. My Father, my Father. You might be a long time encounter like Peter, where you have these battles with pride or ego or failure or jealousy or a desire to be superior. Who's going to be at the right hand? Me? Who's going to be more important? Or telling the kids, off you go. Jesus hasn't got time for you. Only the important people like me. I don't know what things need transformation in your life. I don't know, and Tara and the team, if you could come and just close us with a song, because I just want us to reflect now on what the things are that an encounter with Jesus and a transformation would absolutely change. Is there an unforgiveness that's just stuck and it's like a weight that you can't move past and it's only going to be a supernatural encounter? That you understand that Jesus is God, he's the Messiah, and he has control over nature, over our emotions, over everything. And that when we submit to him, things can move. That might be you. It might be your thinking. You know, you might be somebody who has patches of, in your thinking, you sort of got it right, but then you slip back and you kind of end up where you were. Do you need transformation in your thinking about yourself, about your worth? You need to see your worth. Jesus sees you as he sees his son, his beloved. You are his beloved. You may need a transformation in your thinking that can only come from an encounter with Jesus when you truly understand who he is and what he's done. There might be other parts of your life that's just a struggle or a battle, that you feel stuck. I want you to see Peter here standing up. He's courageous instead of prideful. He's confident. He's free. He's not guilty. He's not back in the boat with the boys. He's free and he's courageous and he knows who he is and he's telling the world. He turned the world upside down along with those early believers. They were incredible because they came to understand who Jesus is. But the same Jesus, the same covenant, the same relationship is reached out to us today. And that is the good news of the gospel. Let's stand, and as we just close in a song, I just want us to really reflect. If there's things that you need to see Jesus as truly the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who we've been waiting for, who has the power to forgive, to heal, just reach out in your heart, in your thinking, in your voice. He's faithful and he loves to heal, he loves to forgive, and he loves to be able to call you his son or daughter, and that we might in return call him my father. Thanks, Tara.